introduce our guest speaker for the month of October, speaking on steps 6, 7, 8, and 9, Peter M. from Brooklyn.
Everybody, I'm Peter, I'm an alcoholic. I'm tempted to say all rise, but I won't. Very grateful to be a recovered member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and again, thank the group and Michael for this very kind invitation to me to be here to share with you my experience and hope from this message that I've gotten from the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I'll share something with you. Oftentimes, we do some things, I know I do in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we're looking for the big picture, the big meaning, the burning bush or the seas parting, and the answer is like so simple and right in front of us. So tonight around 5:30, I sit in meditation, and I'm in this meditation, and it was a wonderful time. I mean, I'm talking to my God, He's talking to me, and we're on this journey, and we're talking back and forth, and, you know, it was a really neat experience. And I got some really neat information in this meditation, and then it got really quiet. And I sat there, and I'm listening to the silence, if you will, and suddenly this little voice says, "Get ready." And I come out of meditation, and I stand up, I say, "Get ready. Get ready for who? For what? It's the end of the world. What am I, get ready. What am I going to do?" And I saw the alarm clock. It said 10 after 6. And I realized, get ready to get here. Tonight I was going to be late. And so sometimes, you know, you're looking for this big picture, and God's saying, you know, "Schmuck, you want to get dressed? You got to be here." I tell you, I'll share a story. I know some of you guys may be familiar with this story. Between standing up here tonight and taking myself a little too serious in this meditation, interesting thing happened to me a handful of years ago on my travels to Mexico one time. My wife and I decided to travel to Ixtapa, Mexico. We had been to other parts, and we wanted to try this one spot. She had a brainstorm about Ixtapa, Mexico. So we decided to go down there, and anytime I get an opportunity to travel, the first thing I do is call up New York Intergroup and find out where the AA meetings are. And that's what I did, like always. I called up New York Intergroup, and I asked them for a meeting in Ixtapa, Mexico. They never even heard of Ixtapa, Mexico. And I said, "Well, there's got to be a meeting down there. AA's all over the world. Find one." And I suddenly had a committee on the other end of the phone looking for Ixtapa, Mexico in the computer, and they had nothing. And one person suggested that I call up Mexico City, the intergroup over there, that main intergroup office. So, you know, I decide to call Mexico City. I'm living in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, and I'm calling Mexico City. And the guy on the phone didn't speak English, and I don't speak Spanish. So if you're anything like me, if someone doesn't understand your language, what do? Is I holler at the person. So I'm barking over the phone thinking that would get the message across, and I think he was cursing back at me in Spanish. And I called a few times, and I got some woman on the phone who spoke a little bit of English. He gave me a phone number for a gentleman who lived down there. And I called him up, and he says, "Well, we don't have English-speaking meetings. What we do have is a bunch of us to get together in a coffee shop. And we'll talk." And I said, "Good enough. I'll call you when I get down there." And so I get down, I check into the hotel, and I ring this guy up first thing, and there's no answer. And I call him the second day, and I call him a bunch of times. And finally, he gets back to me, and he tells me, "Well, maybe we'll get together next week sometime." And I said, "Well, you know, I'll be back in Brooklyn. That's a little bit late." He said, "Why don't you try a Spanish-speaking meeting in Zihuatanejo? A meeting's a meeting, you know." And I said, "Good enough." And he told me where the meeting was. And I head out of my hotel from Ixtapa down to Zihuatanejo. And this was, I'm going to say, about an hour cab ride, 45-minute cab ride. And I leave these really nice confines of my hotel, and I'm approaching Zihuatanejo, and it's getting worse and worse. The poverty that I was to encounter, I never saw anything like it before. People were living in metal containers, trailer containers, and these wooden huts, and they couldn't afford shoes to wear, and their clothes were torn. It was a tough time. And as I drove up to this meeting place, I was on vacation. I had some money in my pocket and some new clothes on, and I remember taking my jewelry off. because I felt really uncomfortable with it. I don't know the last time these people ate, and I had some jewelry on and new clothes. I was a little awkward about that. And I walked to about 30, 40 guys outside the meeting place, and I asked about the AA meeting, and they pointed to the back, and some guy came out, and he spoke perfectly good English. And he was there by way of California, very successful in California. And he was in the process of getting his family back to the West Coast with him. And I remember him telling me he had a brother who lived in Staten Island, of all places. And so what we did, we sat down, and I shared a little bit of my story with him, and he did with me. And suddenly, God provided me with a newfound friend. And I went into the meeting, and I caught the tail end of a business meeting. And there was about, I don't know, 50, 60 people there, and most of them were men, just a few women. And with the most enthusiasm I have seen at any business meeting to get a commitment to make coffee, to clean the bathroom, to clean up the sink, whatever it was as if their life depended on the next service commitment they did. And I wish I could say that about other AA halls. But that's what was going on here, and it was a two-hour format with eight speakers. And I remember going back a couple of nights later and met my friend, and now the guys knew me and they welcomed me in, and I sat down in the back, way in the back. And you know, I remember walking in and seeing a picture of Bill and Bob, and although the steps were in Spanish, they were raw steps. And there was a circle and a triangle. And although the words were in Spanish, the circle and the triangle was my circle and a triangle. And I felt home in another place, which is one of the wonderful things about Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'm sitting in the back, and the speaker's position was like this, off on the side, like St. Patrick's Cathedral. I mean, it was this thing. And first speaker got done, and the chairperson pointed to the back where I was sitting with my friend, and he pointed to me, and my friend says, "Come on, let's go." I says, "Go where?" He said, "Speak." I says, "Where am I going to speak?" He's up front. I says, "I don't speak Spanish." He says, "You speak, I'll interpret. Don't worry about it." And so I get up there, and I remember thinking, "God, get me out of this one. I'll never drink again." And so I stand in front of these people, and they're looking at me like, "Who's this guy? Where did you get him from?" And it was as if, I always share this, it was as if I was standing in front of my first meeting and giving my first talk. I had that moment. And I said, what am I going to share with these people? What can I possibly share? And you know when you remove yourself from wherever you are and turn in to God? And that's exactly what I did. I said, "Father, please give me words here because I'm a little stuck." And I began to say who I was. And I looked at my friend who was standing to my right. And when I said I was an alcoholic, I could have sworn he says, "You're not kidding." But he didn't say that. He interpreted everything I said. And I would look at him and he would interpret. And just a few minutes into this talk, you know when you know people are identifying with you and they're walking your journey with you. And I turned to God for words, and I learned a very valuable lesson, a lesson that I heard about in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now is to experience it. And that is when we speak from the heart, we touch the heart, because Bill always said, this is the language of the heart. And we were worlds apart, really. And I know where I was and have a good idea where they were. We were brought together with a common problem and a common solution in this sacred place called Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I got done, they let me know how grateful they were for me coming down and sharing my story with them. And, I mean, I've had the privilege of speaking at many, many places, thank the good Lord. This was just a little bit different, though. This place was in a sordid spot in Zihuatanejo, and yet the Spirit of God was alive, and the love that was in the room was insurmountable. And I was a part of it, and that was just a great thing for me. The flip side of this whole story, though, is me and my trying to be a great AA member one particular day. On my way to this meeting, I had the address, and I got the brainstorm that I was going to be a super spiritual giant this day and protect anonymity at all costs, because I want to uphold my traditions and be a good member of AA. So I'm going to protect anonymity. So what I do is I go down to the lobby where the bellhops are. And I call the bellhop over in my best Brooklyn spiritual attitude. I says, "Come here for me, I want to talk to you." And and he came over, and I said, "I want to go here." And he said, "CCC, AA, AA." I said, "But keep it quiet. I don't want anyone to know where I'm going." And so what he did was he walked out to where all the cabs are lined up, blew the whistle, and yelled out, "Alcoholico, Alcoholico." And I remember that woman clutching their purses and holding their children close by. And the entire hotel knew that I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I think it's Rule 62 says not to take ourselves too seriously. And, you know, God has a sense of humor. Sometimes I look for the big picture, and it's really right in front of me. I'm very grateful to be a recovered member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and as a recovered member, I automatically assume a responsibility to uphold the traditions as well as the tradition of Alcoholics Anonymous, to study our literature and to listen to the experiences of our old-timers, not just to know more, but to understand more. The way I've been brought up here is when I understand what it is I belong to, I become a better member. Alcoholics Anonymous has saved my life. The very least I can do is not only be an awakened member, but also be an informed member of this place called Alcoholics Anonymous, and to pass this message on that was so freely given to me. One of the things I'm very grateful for is in where I am currently is doing a lot of unlearning of old ideas that didn't work and experiencing new ideas that do work, and cutting loose from some of my attachments that I held on to for dear life that I worshipped, and were moving me little by slowly into parts of page 52 in our big book. And I wondered, what is my dilemma? I'm going to meetings, I'm writing inventory, I'm doing all of this stuff, and yet I'm experiencing certain areas of my life that are causing me some dis-ease and discomfort. What is wrong? I call my sponsor 3 times a week. I'm working with others. I'm doing a lot of things I'm told to do. I'm very disciplined in my inventory. Yet why do I feel like on certain days I'm flatlined? What's going on? What seemed to be a problem, as I heard a gentleman say, turned out to be a great opportunity, which is what we get here as we move along in this journey. What seemed to be problems as we're walking along and following directions, I'm not talking about just showing up here and expecting, you know, things to happen, but following directions in these disciplines, sometimes what happens is we pull back new layers, and there's a problem presented to us, and we wonder, okay, what do I do now? What did I do, but what didn't I do? It's really God's way of presenting another opportunity for me to grow up spiritually, to go a little bit deeper so I can go out, to go in so I can go out. And this is what I've encountered over the last few months with this work. And what at first seemed to be a problem turned out to be a wonderful opportunity. And what was presented to me seemed to be a flimsy reed. And once again, it proved to be the loving and powerful hand of God, because I had to turn back to this power, and I was made right size. And going through that, it's a little bit uncomfortable. There's a squeezing that goes on, I have found, as we go along in this work, especially when we hit that 10, 11, and 12, there's a squeezing that goes on. You know, if you use a sponge to kind of clean your kitchen sink, every so often you run it under the water and you squeeze it to get what's out, so you make room for new. If I fill up this glass to the top and try to put new water in, it's just going to overflow. It has to be emptied out in order to be filled up. And for me, that squeezing that was happening was a little uncomfortable. I had 14 years of being sober in here. Why am I getting squeezed again? And I wasn't too sure. See, my book is really clear that alcohol is a subtle foe, that I should not rest on my laurels. I remember my sponsor having me look up these words, subtle and foe, because, like, I went to the University of Bensonhurst, Brooklyn, and I had no idea what subtle and foe meant. Subtle was this sly, clever, devious, difficult to detect, and a foe was this personal enemy. Great words for alcoholism. So, you know, I'm around here a little while, and I shared last week about becoming a prey to comfortability. It'll come back and bite me. And I finally, you know, you find yourself living all over page 52 wondering what's going on. But here I was being squeezed, and, you know, what do I do? About a year or so ago, this gentleman came out to New York to give a talk, and I had heard some of his talks before on tape, and I was very much impressed with what he had to say. Very much impressed, but super intimidated to even talk to the guy. And finally, I mustered up enough courage, and I spoke to this guy one time, and that quiet voice asked me to encourage me to ask him for help. And he went back to Texas and came back up here for another weekend big book seminar. And we talked a little bit further, and he had given me some information before he got here, while he was here, and has been helping me since. And this has been a great experience for me, having a new teacher, new experiences, and understanding because of the experience I've had, not just words that I'm giving you, the experience I've had of staying current. Too often I've heard people, you know, give a talk about a fourth step that happened 40 years ago, you know, 20 years ago, 15 years ago. Where are you now? Where am I right now? And sometimes that's a little bit uncomfortable to go through all this work again. I learned again about the problem in step one, the unmanageability, what that's all about, the allergy, the obsession to alcohol, the phenomenon of craving, that whenever I drank alcohol, the craving was always intensified, never satisfied. Part of my unmanageability wasn't only the way I was living, but the unmanageability of not having a clue as to when I was going to pick up again, just knowing it was going to happen. And once I picked up, all bets were off. I bought back hell every time. And I was brought to this bitter end, to this jumping off place, and Alcoholics Anonymous gave me my solution in step two, that this loving God was going to restore me to sanity, wholeness of mind, where my mind was freed of the obsession to drink alcohol, which meant there was no compulsion, no obsession, allergy going on because of a spiritual awakening I would be given. This was promised to me. This wasn't, well, maybe this will happen if you do this. Like most things that happened in my life, this was promised to me. This was one of the great things that happened to me, and they said it was. I made a decision in three to get to that solution. I began house cleaning 4 through 9. And I was told early on, if you want to know how to work step 3, put pen to paper in 4. Go sit down with someone in 5 and complete the rest of this work. I saw many things about me in step 4. Many things that I wasn't too thrilled about seeing. My selfish and self-centeredness across the board. How my life was driven by fear, even when I didn't think it was driven by fear. My fourth column was the most uncomfortable thing to look at, yet it was the most freeing thing. When a book talks about we're prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle, boy, oh boy, that's not always a pleasant chore. But at the same time, in that squeezing, there's a great freedom. In the discipline of this work, there's a great freedom that happens. That's the byproduct of it, if you will. The discipline, there's freedom. And I saw some things about me that I wasn't too thrilled about. My life driven by fear. I just thought being angry was being tough. I didn't know what was fueling that was fear. When I would isolate, I thought I just it was too good. I didn't want any part of this world. Stay away from me because you're too painful. I didn't know the isolation was being fueled by fear. These are some of the things that were revealed to me. Go through a sex inventory, a fear inventory. Principles, institutions, all of these things that was this wedge that blocked me from this power I had to face for the first time and be rid of for the first time in my life. These things which were going to set me free. You know, you look at it at first, it's like, what an order, I can't go through it. Thank the good Lord for good sponsorship. And I say good for a reason. I don't mean one person is better than another. What I mean by that is someone who's had an experience with this information, a real alcoholic sponsoring someone who needs this information. Not someone, and bless them, don't drink and go to meetings, sponsoring someone who needs this information. If they don't, they will drink and die. And I've seen that many times, often. Don't drink, go to meetings, join the AA sober team, the softball team. You'll be fine. Go make coffee. There's sobriety in the coffee pot. I'm sober almost 15 years. I'm still looking for it. But when you get the sponsor who's the real alcoholic of our type, who experiences these three things, the obsession, the compulsion, and the spiritual malady, and has had an awakening through this book, sponsors that other person, great things happen. Not only for the prospect, for the sponsor also. I've been on both sides. So I had this all this work done in my fourth step, and I had to go sit down with my sponsor in 5. And I remember my big book telling me that if I may not get over drinking if I didn't take this step. Well, that was enough information to go there and sit down with this guy in 5. And yet I remember thinking when I first started with my sponsor, this guy must have invented Alcoholics Anonymous because he walks on water. He's that much above everything for me. First time I ever encountered a man like this in my entire life. And there were certain teachers that were put right in my life right before my sponsor. But then this guy shows up. After me making prayer to my God, put a sponsor in my life, this guy shows up, and he was it. I had to go to his house to share my fifth step, and suddenly I wasn't too sure about this guy. Old ideas were coming back. Because I shared this last week. I grew up with, you know, the only thing you trust is the money in your pocket. You don't tell anyone anything, especially those intimate things. And if you think I'm going to sit down with another man and talk about my sex life, you're out of your mind. This is not going to happen. And I got that feeling, you know, that feeling we get in our gut when something's not right. And what came back to me was the horror show I had left off when I got here in June 23rd, 1988. And I hit my knees and I made a prayer, and God got me to this guy's house, and I sat down and I shared with this guy. Now, when I got done with my fifth step, some things happened to me. I remember feeling like I was really part of Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time. I was really like I was doing something. There was a great relief that I was experiencing, that this work was done up until this point. We have some fifth step promises they talk about. And I remember feeling not only relief, but one of the promises, feeling the nearness of our Creator. And I remember not only feeling that, but the nearness of another human being. God does work through people. One person knew me my entire life, top to bottom. I told this guy my entire life story. And not a biography when I say life story, my inventory. A book says we're quiet for 1 hour, and we move on to six-step questions, and then into seven, and so on. And I felt really good, so I took an hour, and I took a day, and I took a week, and a month. And it was about 2 months later or so, and I was getting sick because I didn't move on. And I was going to meeting Sharon, I just finished my fifth step, and talking away this wonderful experience I had, and not moving on. And I start to get this, becoming restless, irritable, and discontented. I start to look at AA speakers with kind of a cross eye, like, I don't know how legit they are. And do I really need to call my sponsor? I'm feeling good. Now, as a gentleman in town not too long ago said something that kind of knocked me off my chair. If it feels good, it doesn't always mean it's good. If it feels bad, it doesn't always mean it's bad. And I was feeling good, and that was bad. Because I wasn't moving on. And I was starting to get sick, spiritually sick. I was becoming, if you will, untreated. I was getting blocked again from this power that had just moved me from hell to freedom. I remember calling up my sponsor, and in some very earthy language, he reminded me of my refusal to move on, and this is one of the any lengths. And what I had to do was sit down in prayer and meditation and go back through the five proposals, review if I had left anything out, and move on to step six. And there's some things I had to consider in step six. But I think God can take from me everything that I consider was objectionable. Now, a lot of things, I took that out. That was my fourth column. There were a lot of things in my fourth column that were certainly objectionable. Those are the things that were blocking me from this power. Well, the answer to that question was yes. And can he now take them all, every one? And the answer to that question was yes. See, what I learned is I need to show up with a spirit of willingness, and that's part of my sixth step. I need to show up with a spirit of willingness. And based on the first five proposals, I was brought to a place of willingness. I just got, felt cured for a little while and kind of rested on my laurels once again. Going through the first five proposals, I saw the horror show, and I relived the horror show, and that certainly propelled me into moving on. There's some questions on the bottom of page 60. I forget the page, but right before we get into our sixth step, it talks about, have I tried to make, skipped on the cement? Are my stones properly in place? I pictured this laborer trying to build this archway for me to walk through free and kind of taking shortcuts. I was a union worker for a long time. I know all about shortcuts. And most of those things don't stand too long. And I pictured this labor of taking shortcuts. Did I want that, or did I want the solid foundation? And I had to review my five proposals to make sure I wasn't trying to skip by with anything, trying to sneak anything through this archway. And that came after a lot of prayer, some more inventory, and some meditation, and sitting down with my sponsor, and sharing about some of the things that I may have left out the first time. And based on that spirit of willingness, I hit my seventh step. And what I found out, my seventh step has nothing to do with me. It has everything to do with being maximum service to God and people around me. Once again, I'm turning good and bad to God, because it's not for me to decide what's good about me. That would be awfully arrogant. I may think something's good, think I do something good, or this is good for me, and it may not be, and something that I think is not good for me is exactly what God needs for me to do. So I just once again turn everything to God like I did in step three. they talk about in this prayer, to go out from here, right from that place, to do His bidding, not mine. His bidding was the stuff I had to do in 8 to be ready, and 9 go repair the damage that I caused out of my effort to live life on self-will. Step 8 talks to, they use great words, damage and debris. Later on in step 10, they talk about a tornado roaring through the lives of others. A tornado leaves town, is damage and debris. That was me. For me to tell you just don't go to meetings, that's a lie. It's contrary to my book. And I sat with this 7-step prayer and I showed up at step 8. And before I move on to step 8, it's important for me to share what happened to me this last time going through this work. I think the first time going through, I was kind of like being led around. This is, what do I do next? Because I'm dying the way I was. Just tell me what to do. This last time, I had a different experience. I sat with my sponsor, my current sponsor, and I turned over all my thoughts in this 5th-step experience. And he, like the first time I went through, did not judge me once. You know, didn't look at me like there was something wrong with me. He listened and related a lot of similar experiences that he had that was similar to mine. He gave me some information to go out from there with. We talked further. We got a little bit deeper into some inventory. It was a very comforting time for me, as uncomfortable as it was going through. And I remember when I got done, he gave me some instructions for 6 and 7. I went home and I was quiet for 1 hour. And I thank God from the bottom of my heart that I knew him better. A book talks about where we may have had spiritual beliefs, we now begin to have a spiritual experience. And the first time it may have been the infancy of one, but it was starting. And what I didn't know, it was going to be the infancy once again for me of this new experience. A new experience. And I went home for an hour and I did my prayer and I went through the first 5 proposals. And I did something really silly. I heard people do this. I had to put my book on a shelf and take it down from the shelf. I don't know, I just had to do it. You know, and so I took it down from the shelf and I followed directions. I got done with prayer and some of the suggestions that I were given. And then I sat in meditation. And when I came out of meditation, I remember calling my sponsor and we had a talk. And I was given some instructions out of our book for 6. And this is what happened to me. I remember I went out for a little while and I came home and I sat in prayer and it was as if, I'm trying to explain this, it was as if I was brand new in Alcoholics Anonymous and I was scared to death. I felt as if I had absolutely nothing and I had no idea what was going on. What I have found out is when I can't explain something, it's usually God. But I didn't know that then. And I remember turning to my God with my 7-step prayer, scared to death, because there were no thoughts of a drink, but I just didn't know where I was going for the first time. It was a very uncomfortable experience. And I said my 7-step prayer, and I remember talking to my God, to save me from me. That's what came out of this. Save me from me. The very next day, I remember there was a couple of things that happened, personal things that happened to me, and I couldn't do what I wanted to like I used to, no matter how much I tried. There was something that moved me from my old behavior into this new place, and I had no idea what was going on. I was scared to death, and I called my sponsor, and he says, it sounds like you're getting free to me. You've been made new again. No matter how much I tried to rely on old ideas, they didn't work. I couldn't take that action anymore. And I had to be still. One of the most difficult things for me, and I know probably a lot of us here, is to be still and just be. And that's what I had to do this Sunday afternoon. And I'm waiting for the shoe to drop any minute. At the end of the day, I was so grateful that I just was able to be, because everything worked out perfect. And I kept thinking, now, if I would have fought my way through this and put my hands on the wheel, it wouldn't have turned out this way, and I would have had more troubles of my own making, saying, now what do I do? And what I've learned over the last few months here is sometimes I just be with my God. Some of the things I learned about me that I had to let go of, you talk about some of the things we cling to. What was I clinging to? Well, for me, you know, I said earlier, anger, I always thought was me being tough. It was fueled by fear. I remember spending many, many days in isolation. Shades down, phone off the hook, TV on, no sound, in the dark. Afraid to move. Afraid to move. What was that about? Was I willing to let go of that? Certainly. How do I do that? There are many things that showed up in my with these defects of character that I had to be free of. I don't blame anyone for this, but the way to kind of deal with life, I used to deal with life on life's terms. It has become life on God's terms for me now. But the way I was able to live life on life's terms was get you before you get me and judge everybody. And I would hold people up to the highest levels of perfection. They had to fall short. And when you did, I was angry with you. I would hold me up higher than I would hold these people up, and I was doomed to fail all the time. And I would come down on myself. This judge would scream at me, "I told you you're no good." And there was another part of me that says, "He's right. You aren't." Attachments to things like this were killing me. You know, I find fault with anything someone did. And then I remembered something I read, that before I take the speck out of your eye, let me first take the beam out of mine. I remember reading this and I was knocked off my chair. I says, "I think they wrote that one for me." Judgment of others, judgment of myself. This other thing I encountered, I just the worst critic of myself. This judge would bark at me. Let me tell you, standing here tonight, the judge doesn't have too much juice anymore, because I've been set free a day at a time here. He talks. I don't listen. I tell him, "Thanks for sharing, get on with my life." I turn to this loving and caring God, this God of safety, of refuge. Here it goes again. Move me out of this. And I moved out of it. But I had this terrible, terrible dilemma of self-forgiveness. You know, I would condemn you and then forgive you, but with me, another ballgame. I would drive me right to hell because I did something wrong, because I didn't say hello to you yesterday, and you saw me today, and I know you don't like me, and I'm an idiot for forgetting to say hello to you, and let's just, you know, throw in our cards and go home. This is a terrible way to live. When a book talks about bondage of self, this was it for me. And I know I'm skipping over, you know, leaving out a whole lot of stuff because we just don't have enough time. But there was so much revealed to me. And when I hit my knees this last time taking the 7-step prayer, I showed up with, "Father, please, I got nothing. Take me from this. Save me. You have to. Save me from me." And I was. Ain't that great? Isn't that great? Based on my track record, where I have been, and how many times when I was out there, I cursed God for doing these terrible things to me, to my family, to my mom. I show up here 14 years later in Alcoholics Anonymous, and He saves me again. And when I found out, He's been saving me since I walked in here, trying to save me my entire life. A book says the great reality is deep down within. It's been there before the first beat of my heart, and will be there long after I'm gone. This is great news to me who suffers from alcoholism. When I found out being here a few years, as much as it is about the drink, it's about some other things too that I need to stay away from that first drink. Because when I think I'm cured, guess what's walking back to me? The first drink. And it happens. Suddenly shows up. My illness is not going to knock on the door and say, "Listen, tomorrow morning about 10, I'll be here." Suddenly, the thought crossed my mind, you know, and I wonder, how did this happen? I've seen it happen over and over and over again, Alcoholics Anonymous. Step 8. One of the things about step 8 is I am not on that list. You know, God's on that list. A lot of other things are on this, but I am not on that list. And if I've done my work up until this point, I will be in a place of willingness for most of these amends. Showing up with this 7-step was almost, if you will, my first step for life, once again. And so I was moved into this amends place. But with step 8, I had to acquire a spirit of willingness. Did I have it or not? And if I didn't, I had to ask until it came. And I looked at this list, and I became willing to hit everyone on that list, and willing to go wherever I had to go to make amends. But I was acquiring a spirit of willingness. Now, a book talks about any lengths, like three times over, from how it works into step nine. So we come out of step seven with the amen, and it says now we needed more action. It doesn't tell us to kind of kick back, to rest on your laurels. They're constantly giving us information like now, next, vigorous, more action. It says faith without works is dead. I need to take action to continue to grow along spiritual lines. And then it tells me, remember the beginning, it was agreed we would go to any lengths for victory over alcohol. Once again, they're hitting me with any lengths. So if I thought I was cured, they're reminding me to continue to move. And I had to become willing to hit everyone on that list. And in step nine, there were some really neat things that happened to me my first time through and this last time through. I'm going through my list, and I'm willing to make amends to almost everyone on that list. And then there's a part in a big book that talks about how to approach the man we hated will arise. And once again, I had identification with my book, and they were writing something for me. Before I got sober, I was living in this little studio apartment that I got thrown out of. And I got thrown out of there because I had basically trashed the place. I had brought, like, the Lower East Side into this place. It was certainly a livable little studio. And when I got thrown out of there for not paying rent for too long of a time, I was living in, one might say, hell. I was drinking blackberry brandy, and I had brandy bottles all over the place. I got addicted to some other things, and what was left of that was all over the place. I had sold everything in the place. The phone, took it out of the wall, the TV. I had dress clothes that my father would buy me from the store, and they would still be in boxes, and I sold all of them, dress shoes, everything untouched to sell to get for the next drink. My bed was soiled because I wasn't making it to the bathroom at night. It was garbage all over the place, filthy laundry. This is how I was living. And when I got thrown out of this place, I hated the landlord upstairs. I hated what he had done to me, especially throwing me out, because I had to go live on the streets. And I don't give this lip service. I had a lot of bad feelings for this guy. Now, this guy had his home. He had a little one with his wife, and one was on the way. And he was going to school besides working a full-time job. And I show up. And I hated everything he and his family represented, but there was a part of me that wanted to be like that, to have that family, to come home from work and have my wife there in a home, not just this structure I call a house, but a home. And I got thrown out, and I had to go live on the streets for a while. Well, here I am with this guy's name on this list. How to Approach the Man We Hated Will Arise, and it talks about how we take the bit in our teeth, that nothing can be worthwhile until I do so, until I make this mess. Nothing can be accomplished in life until I do so. This was important for me to go do this, and I experienced what happens when you don't. I'm in a restaurant with my wife. We were dating. And I'm in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, and walk into this restaurant. I go to the back, and on the other side of this restaurant is a family having one of these get-togethers. And who's standing there is this old landlord. And he's talking to this other gentleman, and I'm sitting in this booth with my wife, and he's giving me a dead eye from across the room. And he's talking to this guy, and the sweat starts to pour off my forehead. And I tell Andrew, who's my wife, I said, let's get out of here. I got to get out of here. She said, what's the matter? I said, I'll talk to you later. I can't talk now. I've got to get out of here. I couldn't even talk. I was shaking all over, and I got out of there. And I call up my sponsor, and he says, meet me by this meeting, and we were talking. And I said, I think he was, you know, recognized me and that he was talking about me. He says, wouldn't you be talking about you if you saw you in a restaurant? What I realized is I was not free. I was still in bondage to self. I was still in bondage to my past. My past still owned me. I was not yet free. How can I come to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, known as Amends to Be Made, and say I'm doing my ninth step, say I'm free? How can I tell you I've went into the world of the Spirit when I've unfinished amends that I am aware of? And this was one of them, and I was not free. So I had to go back into inventory and write what was blocking me from making amends to this guy. Why do I still have the hate for this gentleman? What was in the way? And I wrote lots of inventory, shared it with my sponsor, prayer and meditation. Prayer and meditation. The most difficult ones our book talks about seem to be the most beneficial. One morning I'm in meditation, it was a Sunday morning, and I finished my meditation, and I found myself getting dressed. I was told, if I have an appointment with someone, you go be the best example of this book because you may be the only copy they're ever going to read. And if you're going to go make amends for a damaged past, you better show up looking like you recovered. And you certainly better deliver this message. And that's what I was taught, and I got dressed something like I am tonight. And I wasn't sure what I was doing, but I had this subtle idea where I was going. And I show up to this guy's house, and I knock on his door, and his wife answered, and I walked in, and I sat with him. And without dragging them through the mud, I shared about the damage I had caused, how truly sorry I was. I made financial restitution during this talk. And then I asked him, is there anything that you need to tell me that I'm not aware of that I haven't talked about yet? They're very grateful I wasn't living downstairs from them anymore. They were really, really happy that I was getting on with my life and that I had this new life. We talked a bit, and it was civil. Really, it was civil. What happened to me afterwards, my words are going to fall short. But when our book talked about in our fifth step promises, we feel the nearness of our Creator, we're walking hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe, I experienced that here. I left this guy's house, and I was on my way to my car, and I don't remember really walking to my car, except feeling as if the fist of Gulliver went down into my chest and ripped out the last of the poison. I don't even remember touching the sidewalk as I walked to my car. It was this weird experience that was going on, but it was the most freeing experience I had. It was incredibly freeing. And I felt, you know, when God shows up, God shows up. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. When God shows up, He shows up, and it's profound. And something, you know, you could be driving your car, paying a toll, or in traffic, in the shopping store, wherever it is, God shows up. There's something that happens that you're very, very much aware of. And I was certainly aware of it when I left this gentleman's house. I was on different footing. My roots grasped new soil when I left that guy's house. I felt one. I was integrated, finally, with the Spirit. There was no wedge. And that's because of some of the freeing that happened here, because of the work I did prior to it. I heard a gentleman say, am I making the ground fertile for God to do His work? A farmer plants. God does the growing. You know, a doctor operates. God does the healing. They create the environment for this to take place. And I saw, looking back, how this was done for me. All I had to do was follow a few simple rules. I'm so grateful for the horror I experienced getting here. Going through seven rehabs, being homeless and locked up, and all the complete horror show that I experienced getting here, because it moved me here tonight. It moved me to go through that work and follow directions and say, what do I do now? Occasionally I balked. Occasionally I looked at my sponsors like they were completely nuts. Like maybe they need to go through the steps again, not me. But there was that little thing that goes on inside of here that says, Peter, just follow directions, follow this path. And I listened. And I'm so grateful I did. And I don't know how many times that was a conscious decision to follow. It's just you follow. Thank the good Lord. I had to sit with my family in my ninth step, and they had heard many of my promises, many times, only to be broken the very next day. So I was told to wait, and I prayed and I waited. And I remember going to sit down with my dad, which was emotionally probably the toughest one I had to do. My dad caught all of my alcoholism. He watched my mom die from this. And then I show up, and he goes through it all over again. And he told me later on, many nights, he just thought I wasn't going to make it anymore. My kid brothers gave up on me because of what alcoholism does. It levels everything in our path. And I knew I had to go sit with my dad. I said, how am I going to sit with this man? Making lots of meetings, very active in Alcoholics Anonymous. How am I going to do this? And one day, I asked my dad if I can sit and talk with him about some stuff. And my dad, as always, says anything. Well, you know, let's go talk. And my dad would take me off to the side and we'd talk. And I started to make this amends, and I even tried to make financial restitution. My father would not have it. Before I even got the words out, my father stopped me and he says, all I ever wanted was to have my son back. And he is. I've been told wonderful things in Alcoholics Anonymous over the years. Those words, I hold on to till God takes me from here, because he and I took this direction in a new path for the first time. I used to see my dad walk in a room and I, you know, look to jump out the window. And I never felt like I got the respect, or there was this thing going on between him and I for a long time. And because of what takes place in here, Alcoholics Anonymous, I sat with this man and we were put on a different path and I was set free. And our relationship today, I don't give the slip service, is indeed miraculous. It's wonderful because of what took place here. And I was able to sit with this man and look him in the eye and finally call him my dad and believe it and feel it, not just dad in name. I sat with both my brothers about the horror I had caused them. Very recently, I went back to my brothers. There was something that was bugging me that I felt was unfinished, going through this work once again. It was something called abandonment. We moved to Staten Island. I was consumed by alcoholism. I left my two kid brothers. I was just wasn't a big brother to them. And I sat with both of them, one at a time, and I let them know, again, how truly sorry I was, if anything you need to tell me. And my youngest brother started to cry in my arms and tell me, you've been the best brother I've ever had in my life. He says, you've done more for me in the last few years that you've been going to Alcoholics Anonymous. He says, whatever they give you, that you keep doing. He says, I look to you like I did when I was a young kid. My middle brother had some more information for me. He says, we just wondered what happened to you. You know, we would go out and play ball and you weren't around, and we would see you, you know, leave in the car and not come home for 3 days. He said, wasn't it? We just knew you were sick and we just didn't want to lose you. And he thanked me for sitting with him. I sat with my grandparents. I share these because this is what God's given me right now to share with you. They're probably the toughest one emotionally. I sat with my grandmother, who I, again, had damaged and stole from. And I went to her house, and I sat down on the couch next to her. My grandfather was on the other side of the couch. And as I started to share with her, she started to cry. And I started to cry. And my grandfather started to cry, and he don't understand English. My grandmother had to interpret, because he's passed on now, but he was from Italy. And I remember him, like, waving, like, it's, you know, don't worry about it. Family, who we damage so terribly, sometimes are so forgiving. And back to what I was talking about earlier, could I be that forgiving? Or do I hold you up to standards when you come to make amends to me? Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. Those aren't words in the Lord's Prayer. Do I live that stuff? Or do I just say it at the end of the meeting because everyone else does? Does that become part of my life or not? I've made over 200 amends, direct approaches. Most of them, or a lot of them, I ought to say, were with truck drivers. I was a longshoreman. And I encountered, you know, through my day, I don't know, 30, 40, 50 longshoremen, truck drivers a day. A lot of illegal things I did. A lot of verbal abuse I gave to truck drivers who could punch me on top of the head and, you know, put me into the ground in a heartbeat. Never did. And I met them one after the other. There was one truck driver I saw was working on the pier, and this gentleman who's about 6'12". I mean, this guy is just this monstrous of a man. And I saw him, and I was praying to complete these amends, and this gentleman shows up. And you know what my owner said? You don't remember. Don't worry about it. And I remember going away from my job site, making a prayer, and coming back and approaching this guy. And this is what happens with amends. He was just so grateful that I remembered how I had harmed him. I almost, like, kind of gave him some respect that I had robbed from him. It isn't only about the money we take, it's about the emotional stuff we rip people off. And now I'm here to set this right. I harmed you, and I know it. You had no right to be treated this way. That goes a long way. And, you know, then we walk this walk. That's really what convinces others also. I sat with many truck drivers. There's this one gentleman that I had no idea where he lived. On the waterfront, everyone has a nickname. You don't know their last name, but you have nicknames. Here I'm praying, God, please let me see Vinny Hilo. Who's Vinny Hilo? God bless you. Who's Vinny Hilo? I don't know Vinny Hilo. He's not one of my children, you know. I don't know the guy's name, and I'm praying, Father, please, this guy's on my list. This is how I don't even know his name except the nickname. And coming out of a lawyer's office one day, I didn't break the law. I had to see a lawyer for something else. And I'm praying to see this guy. And right across the street from this lawyer's office is an OTB. And who's standing right there is this gentleman, Vinny. And my friend's waiting for me, and the car was a rainy Friday. I never forget it. And again, my name is a long time ago. He doesn't need to see you. Father, please. And I go approach this guy. He knew who I was. And I made my financial restitution, and I told him about the wrongs I had caused, anything he needed to tell me. And I sat and I listened. He just didn't appreciate that I borrowed money off of him and never paid him back. Some of the things I've been taught to do is if I borrowed 20 bucks off you 20 years ago, that 20 is worth a little bit more today. If I stole your jacket, I come back with the money for the jacket or a new jacket, and I don't steal anymore. It's about living this. I really hope I've been able to live this with my family by practicing these principles in our homes, occupations, and affairs. I've gone back to old employers and sat with them. Talking about amends to others is a great thing, because what it does is sometimes kick up amends that we're not aware of. Oh, yeah. Going to a meeting, talking about amends with a couple of guys from Staten Island in the car, and what came to me was a public library when I was 5 years old. I borrowed books. A fifth grade, I borrowed books. Never brought them back. And I had to go back. And I walked into this library, I don't know how many years later, but there I am. And the woman was looking for the button on the floor to probably call the cops because she thought it was out of my mind. And I told her why I was there, and I needed to make this right. And I belong to a fellowship, and this is what I do, and this is how I live. And she says, you know, you're not even on a computer. She says, why don't you just forget about it? And I says, well, can I make a donation to this library? And she told me I couldn't. And so what I did with that was I took this number, and I put it back into the universe through charities and stuff. I'm running short on time, but, you know, what about the amends to people you can't show up with, except when to do so would injure them or others? There were some amends based on my background and where I worked. I could not knock on someone's door and say, I did this, because I would implicate a half a dozen other people. I had no right to do that, because I want to go to my meeting and say, I finished my amends, and I just put, you know, six other people in the jackpot. That's not how we live. I need to get their consent first before I go show up. There were some times I couldn't go, and there were some times I could. There was a way to make it right with the universe, though. There was a way to make it right with the universe. There was one amends I had to make with this old girlfriend. I went to see her. She saw me, and she ran across the street. And the first thing I wanted to do was go across the street and say, but I'm an AA, I'm a great guy. I forgot about the times I, you know, verbally and physically abused this girl in a drunk. I came out of a blackout on the F train in downtown Brooklyn beating this girl up. I don't remember how I got there, but I came out of a blackout and I was hitting her. That's horrible. That's deplorable. I don't like men who do that now. But that's where I was brought to, do a horrible thing like that. And I had to go make that right. And she still smarted, if you will, for my injustice to her, and she ran across the street. And I had to leave her and let her be. And treat every woman that God puts in my life with respect and dignity like they deserve. And not treat people like trash anymore. I've been moved to do that, thank God. This has been a great freedom for me, cleaning up my past. I saw my attachments to old ideas in this current inventory, my current agnosticism, where I stand in this. And a few times I was smashed, I heard a gentleman say, smashed right against my stuff until the ego was disintegrated. And I stood before my creator free. Going in was a little uncomfortable. Coming out was a lot easier. sometimes when I was going, I said, okay, God left me this time. I don't know if he's with me on this amends. I don't know if he's with me as I'm going through this. When I come out on the other side, like I shared last week, it reminds me of footprints. When I think I'm alone, it's he who's carrying me, not me doing the carrying. We're just about out of time. Thank you for listening.